West will start to make further inroads in across Northern Ireland and Scotland again. So things going downhill here on Wednesday, with a thickening cloud and some fairly wet weather developing from the northwest as we go through the day. But for England and Wales, fine and very warm again, temperatures if anything even higher. By Thursday, that front will be straddled across the UK as a weakening feature, some patchy rain within it, but dry and bright weather on either side. Looking towards the end of the week, though, it does look like turning particularly wet across England and Wales. So the fine spell not lasting all that long. That's it, Neil. Back to you.
All right. Many thanks, John Hammond. Only twice has America been successfully invaded. Once on the 11th of September, 2001. The previous occasion was in August, 1814. At that time, it was the British who were invading the United States. Our new book of the week is Peter Snow's When Britain Burnt the White House.
On a sweltering August evening, a group of British soldiers and sailors sat down to a meal in the state dining room of America's White House. They hadn't been invited. They had invaded the capital of the United States, had seized the president's house, and were now helping themselves to the meal that he and his first lady had prepared for their guests. To the British officers and men who'd been marching for days, the food and drink were like a gift from the gods. Royal Navy Lieutenant James Scott wrote in his diary that the President's Madeira wine tasted like nectar. It was August 1814. 30 years after the United States had won its independence, the British were back. The extraordinary story of how these intruders, at the head of a British force of 4,500 men, came to occupy and then burn the city of Washington has become the stuff of legend. They set fire to the White House and the Capitol, and it was only a sudden thunderstorm that saved both buildings from more damage. Today, the White House bears the scars, and the scorch marks of the fire can still be seen. But the British invasion of Washington is not an episode in their history that Americans recall with much relish, any more than the French do the Battle of Waterloo. In Britain, very few people know it happened, or even that there was a so-called War of 1812. It was actually one of the defining moments in the history of both countries. For America, it was the only other time, before the terrorist attack of the 11th of September 2001, that outsiders succeeded in striking at the core of American state power. But within 3 weeks, the young republic was to transform utter humiliation into triumph. And Britain was to see one of the most daring and successful military enterprises in its history bring it face to face with the limits of its imperial power. The American watchman on the aptly named Point Lookout awoke to an astonishing sight. Thomas Swan stood gazing at up to 50 warships flying the British flag anchored in the wide expanse of water at the entrance to the Potomac River in Chesapeake Bay. There were troop transports, which Swan reckoned must be carrying thousands of fighting men, and bomb ships, which could cause devastation ashore with their long-range mortars. He was looking at the largest British force to hit the Chesapeake since Britain had tried and failed to crush the American Revolution 30 years earlier. The bay was of great strategic importance. It commanded the approaches to the cities of Washington, Annapolis, and Baltimore. Of the three, Baltimore was the largest and most prosperous, with a well-protected harbor, but Washington had the prestige of being the home of Congress and the President. It was dawn on the 17th of August, 1814. Within hours, the news would be in Washington some 80 miles away. War was about to come to the very heart of the United States. One terrified American eyewitness in the coastal town of York wrote to his local newspaper that the appearance of this formidable enemy fleet could only mean one thing.
Our property destroyed, our dwellings in ashes, our wives and children homeless and defenseless.
The previous evening, the bay had echoed to the thunder of British cannon. It was a salute to the final squadron to arrive, carrying 2,800 troops from southern France. Robert Barrett, a midshipman on the frigate Hebrus, had all the enthusiasm of a young lad of 15 just embarked on a life of adventure.
It was a glorious and imposing spectacle to behold these noble ships standing up the vast bay, manned too with eager souls, panting for fame and opportunity to sustain the laurels they'd gained in many a bloody field of Spain and Portugal.
The British had been fighting a war of survival against Napoleon, so when America's President James Madison declared war on Britain in June 1812, it seemed like a stab in the back. Madison was exasperated by what he saw as the intolerable excesses of the British Empire. In applying a stranglehold on France, Britain had massively interfered with American ships trading with Europe. The Royal Navy also imperiously made a habit of impressing Americans into working on its warships, even if the men could demonstrate that they were American citizens. What was more, Americans driving west to settle in Ohio and beyond felt threatened by Britain's support for the indigenous Indian tribes who stood in their way. But the war hadn't gone well for either side. The Americans had tried to seize slices of Canada, but it proved impossible for the American army to establish a permanent foothold across the frontier. And the British, although they possessed the most powerful navy in the world, suffered as much punishment as they inflicted in several naval encounters, and even had their upper Canadian capital, York, the modern Toronto, burned by an American marauding force in the spring of 1813. The Parliament buildings there were reduced to ashes. Lord Liverpool's Tory government in London was severely short of money after two decades of fighting the French. So with Napoleon's exile to Elba, he leapt at the opportunity of peace in Europe to deal a decisive blow against America. The London Times thundered,
"Now that the tyrant Bonaparte has been consigned to infamy, there is no public feeling in this country stronger than that of indignation against the Americans."
The Duke of Wellington himself showed no enthusiasm for the war in America. He believed that wars should have clearly defined and achievable goals. The American War had neither. But he admired the new army commander, Major General Robert Ross. Ross was a Northern Irishman from Ross Trevor in County Down. He was notably courageous in battle, occasionally reckless. He had a habit of leading from the front and lost a number of horses killed under him. His men were devoted to him. He would occasionally entertain them by playing his violin. An American prisoner who met him later said of Ross,
"He was the perfect model of the Irish gentleman of easy and beautiful manners, humane and brave, and his prisoners had no reason to regret falling into his hands."
Within minutes of arriving in Chesapeake Bay, Ross met the admiral who was to be the driving force of the British blitzkrieg of the next few weeks, Rear Admiral George Cockburn. For the last 18 months, Cockburn had been causing terror and destruction in the Chesapeake. People in coastal towns lived in fear of their homes being burned and their tobacco crop and other valuables being seized and sold for profit by Cockburn's marauding troops. He was often seen accompanying his men ashore. He relished being involved in the action, in his admiral's two-cornered hat and familiar jet-black uniform jacket with gold epaulettes. By the end of 1813, he was being attacked in the American press for behavior it described as brutal and savage. The Boston Gazette called him
"the notorious barbarian Admiral Cockburn. There breathes not in any quarter of the globe a more savage monster than this same British admiral. He is a disgrace to England and to human nature."
Cockburn was not, in fact, as unscrupulous as he liked his enemy to believe. He applied strict rules of engagement. Towns that surrendered to his raids, he would spare. Towns that resisted, he would burn. Livestock and other food, he insisted, should be paid for, never looted. Again, always providing there was no opposition. General Ross and Admiral Cockburn were under the command of a vice-admiral who was one rank senior to each of them. He was Sir Alexander Cochrane, whose flag flew on HMS Tonnant, which had retained her French name since she had been seized by the British at the Battle of the Nile. Cochrane's central strategic objective was to cause the Americans so much punishment on the East Coast that they would be forced to reduce their pressure on Canada. He had been deliberating for some time about where to attack once Ross's army arrived from Europe. Annapolis, Baltimore, and Washington were all possible targets, perhaps Philadelphia up the Delaware River. His rear admiral made it clear that he had no doubt what the approaching task force should do. Coburn said it should strike where it would do most damage to the upstart republic's pride and prestige. The target should be the city that was now the capital of the United States, Washington. General Ross and Vice Admiral Cochrane were not so sure. The Admiralty had intended to give Cochrane a force of 20,000 men. It had now been reduced to just 4,500. This must have been a shock to the Commander-in-Chief. If the Americans could get their act together, they would outnumber the British several times over. But Ross's men were battle-scarred veterans who had thrown the French out of Spain, and they would face untried and poorly trained American militia. Admiral Cochrane was inclined at least to give Coburn's plan a chance. America's capital was still little more than an oversized village with only 8,000 inhabitants. One of President Madison's cabinet ministers was unimpressed.
To a Bostonian or a Philadelphian, Washington appears like what it really is, a meager village, a place with a few bad houses and extensive swamps hanging upon the skirts of a thinly peopled, weak and barren country.
But it was a village with monumental pretensions. It had been chosen by America's first president, George Washington, to be the capital of the new nation. The broad avenues and imposing buildings of state were already partly in place. The two wings of the great stone capitol, the Senate on the north side and the House of Representatives on the south side, were complete. Way off to the west, along the still largely bare but broad Pennsylvania Avenue, stood another group of palatial buildings, the executive offices, the Treasury Building, and in the center, in solitary grandeur, the White House, usually referred to at that time as the President's House. America's second president, John Adams, moved into the mansion briefly on its completion in 1800 and was succeeded by Thomas Jefferson a year later. But it was his successor, James Madison, and his wife, Dolly, who brought the place alive. It was a curious paradox, because Madison was anything but a flamboyant personality. He had a slight, almost shriveled frame, no more than 5'4" tall. He dressed usually in black, looked rather severe, and had a thin and rather diffident voice. His wife, Dolly, could hardly have been more different. She was a buxom, warm-hearted woman with twinkling eyes, eyes that one observer said,
"Wrought havoc with the hearts of the Quaker lads."
She was a natural hostess. She radiated an open bonhomie and disarming friendliness that made her White House the center of Washington society from the moment James Madison became president in 1809. Dolly had a passion for ice cream, which was generously served at her parties, and she was often seen to take a pinch of snuff from a little silver box she carried around. Many Washingtonians blithely dismissed the idea that the British would strike as far inland as the new capital. But as early as the spring of 1813, Dolly was writing to her cousin,
"Although I am a Quaker, I have always been an advocate for fighting when assailed."
As for Coburn, rumors were flying around that he was threatening to burn the White House over her head and carried Dolly off to London to parade her in the streets. By the summer of 1814, Dolly was more concerned about threats to her husband, the president, than to herself.
"I am not in the least alarmed at these things, but entirely disgusted and determined to stay with him."
But by then, the British had arrived in force, and the pugnacious George Coburn had swept away any doubts that remained in the mind of his commander-in-chief, Sir Alexander Cochrane. Washington it would be. They would sail as far as they could up the Patuxent River, land the army at the town of Benedict, and march on the American capital.
When Britain Burned the White House was written by Peter Snow and read by Jamie Parker. It was abridged by Barry Johnston and is a Heavy Entertainment production for BBC Radio 4. The shipping forecast is coming up shortly. And now on BBC Radio 4, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Tuesday, the 3rd of September. There are warnings of gales in Trafalgar and southeast Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. High East Seoul 1030, expected Netherlands 1026 by 1800 Tuesday. New low moving northeastwards, expected West Rockall 1011 by same time. New low expected southwest Fitzroy 1019 by that time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, North at Sarah, South at Sarah, Forties, Cromarty. Northwesterly backing southerly or southwesterly 4 or 5, increasing 6 at times, occasional rain, moderate or good, occasionally poor.